And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
You are constantly reading and hearing about we can't afford the aging of the population, that we're just going to have too few young people supporting too many dependent elderly. And you hear this from Washington, D.C. You hear this from Wall Street Research, nonprofit organizations that, you know, they care, but they have this very negative view of an aging population. And I have rebelled about this, as you know.
Welcome to the Repurpose Your Career podcast, brought to you by Career Pivot. This podcast is where those of us in the second half of life come together to discuss how to repurpose our careers for the 21st century. Come listen to career experts give you proven strategies, listen to people like you tell their stories on how they repurpose their careers, and finally, get your questions answered. Your host, Mark Miller, has made six career pivots over the last 30 years. He understands this is not about jumping out of the frying pan into a fire, but rather to create a plan where you make clear, actionable steps or pivots to a better future career. Are you ready to repurpose your career?
Welcome to episode 117 of the Repurpose Your Career podcast. My name is Mark Miller, and I'll be your host every Monday for a discussion on what it's like to repurpose your career. Career Pivot brings you this podcast. CareerPivot.com is one of the very few websites dedicated to those of us in the second half of life and our careers. Take a moment to check out the blog and other resources that are delivered to you free of charge. If you are enjoying this podcast, please share it with other like-minded souls. Subscribe on CareerPivot.com's iTunes or any of the other apps that supply podcasts. Share it on social media or just tell your neighbors and colleagues. The more people we reach, the more people we can help. Next week, I will be interviewing Ashton Applewhite, author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. This week, I am interviewing Chris Farrell, author of Purpose in a Paycheck, Finding Meaning, Money, and Happiness in the Second Half of Life. Let me read you his bio. Chris Farrell is a senior economics contributor for Marketplace, American Public Media's national syndicated public radio programs. He is economics commentator for Minnesota Public Radio. An award-winning journalist, Chris is a regular contributor to PBS Next Avenue and the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He has written for Bloomberg Businessweek, The New York Times, Kiplinger's, and other publications. I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Repurpose Your Career podcast. Today, I have Chris Farrell, who has just released his book, Purpose in a Paycheck. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why don't we just jump right in? I loved your previous book, Unretirement, and I was very much looking forward to this book. So, but what motivated you to write this book?
So even today, you are constantly reading and hearing about we can't afford the aging of the population, that we're just going to have too few young people supporting too many dependent elderly. And you hear this from Washington, D.C. You hear this from Wall Street Research, nonprofit organizations that, you know, they care, but they have this very negative view of an aging population. And I have rebelled about this, as you know. I think that this is a fundamentally mistaken idea. And I think one of the most exciting grassroots social movements that's going on right now is rethinking the second half of life and rethinking what it is that people with experience can do as they get older. And the fact of the matter is, most people, a majority of people, need to earn an income and want to have work. And what my book is arguing, the positive economics of an aging population. If you were creative in your 20s, your 30s, you're going to be creative in your 60s and your 70s. You need to be given that opportunity. So the book is both a movement that I see gathering momentum and changing the way we think about aging, but it's also about where I'd like us to go as a society to tap into the underappreciated asset, this aging population.
Yeah, there's no question that we are aging differently than our parents did.
Yes.
I mean, very differently. And plus we're all, I took care of, my parents were very old when I was born. My mom was almost 40. So I went through reverse parenting in my late 30s. But a lot of folks are now dealing with their parents and their kids.
That's right.
And so it's a different world.
Well, I say, you know, it really is a different world. And, you know, one of the things is we have these, I don't know what you think, but it seems to me we have these very powerful stereotypes. And it's sort of like, okay, you go to school and then you work and then you retire. And, you know, this is the way things are supposed to be. And you do some caregiving along the way. And what has really struck me is, you know, going to work, people lose their jobs all the time, or people quit their jobs all the time. Caregiving, you're caregiving for your kids. You're caregiving for your aging parents. You know, even if your kids are launched and they're off on their career, you're always a parent. And so we had this sort of very simple, smooth, here's how life evolves. And my sense is life is just a lot of ups, downs, twists, turns, and part of this rethinking of aging is just being much more realistic that if you are caregiving in your 20s because you have a baby, you're probably going to be caregiving in your 50s for your aging parents. And that's the way life is.
Yeah, it's like right now in my online community, one of the things I see is I have a bunch of folks in their late 60s, primarily guys, who still have kids in college.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is called the Vietnam War era draft. In other words, that sucker had a long tail.
It did.
Right. Well, people delayed getting married and having kids. So I've got folks in their late 60s with kids in college, and then I've got folks in their early 50s with kids in college. And what happens is the folks in their 60s with kids in college, they got a lot more obligations that they have to worry about that the younger boomers don't have to.
That's right.
Yep. So I loved your chapter on the myth of creative decline. I thought we're all supposed to experience creative and mental decline in our old age. And, you know, we're supposed to become doddering old men.
That's right.
Can you talk about some of the stories from that chapter?
Well, I went to this exhibit a couple years ago in New York City at the Museum of Modern Art, and it was Matisse. And I don't know if you remember his cutouts. These are these magnificent. He had the Blue Nude series, which is probably his most famous. But these are these magnificent cutouts, and they're large. And Matisse did them between the ages of 74 and 84. He died at age 84. And many art historians, many people just consider this the height of his creativity. And when you start looking at artists, you start realizing that so many artists, as they build on their experience, as they experiment, that they're better in their 60s than they were in their 50s. They're better in their 70s than when they were in their 60s. And then you start looking around, you know, Bruce Springsteen, you know, still, he's in his 60s. He's still performing. He's still playing. He's still writing new songs. And one of the changes that has happened is we're beginning to realize more and more, when there used to be articles about aging artists, usually it was a retrospective, looking back at what they did, or it was kind of the Lizard Lounge story. Look at what they're still singing, the song from when they're 20s. Today, they're very different stories. It's about the new albums that they're coming out with. It's about the new multimedia project. And the closer you look into the artistic community, broadly defined, you know, artists, musicians, sculptors, there are so many people that are building on their experience. They're connecting their dots. And the argument in my book is, okay, this is rarefied air. These are incredible artists. What does this tell us about the rest of us? And then when you look at the research, what the research says is, hey, guess what? That story about this artist is true for Mark and Chris. Now, no one's ever going to go into a gallery looking at our art or is going to listen to our music 50 years from now. But the notion that within an organization or as an entrepreneur, and entrepreneurship is being very creative, as an entrepreneur, that you're somehow uncreative once you hit your 60s, as if there's an expiration date, fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, I'm down here in Ajijic, Mexico, which is one of the largest expat communities in the world. And we had an art walk 2 weekends ago. And there are about 90 artists at about 30 different venues. And 3/4 of them were all expats from Canada and the U.S. And almost all these folks had taken up art and were showing their artwork that they didn't learn until their 60s.
Right.
And I was blown away because and this was all, you know, yes, it was some painting, but it was all kinds of stuff. And one of the questions I asked almost every one of them is, how'd you learn this stuff? And a bunch of them said, YouTube.
Yes.
And it's like, wow. Now, a bunch of them took some classes and some went off to study with masters and they were able to do this in their 60s and 70s. I'm sorry, that's not what I was expecting when I went to this art walk.
You just touched on another stereotype that feeds into this creativity. Your story just absolutely fits nicely into this. There is this image, this conversation out there that, you know, as people get older, they don't adjust to new technology. You know, they just, not going to do that. Turn away from it. And if you think about the boomer generation for a moment, when at my first office job, I had a IBM Selectric, and I was so excited because if you did hit the enter key, you could erase the line that you had just typed. Incredible. Unbelievable, because I was a terrible typist. Well, you go through that, went to the word processor, went to the PC. Now we're at the mobile phones. Now we're using the iPad. We're on Facebook. I mean, the thing about technology in age, maybe at one point in time it was true, but it is no longer true. Just as the people that you were asking your questions to while you're doing the art walk were going to YouTube. They didn't even think about going to YouTube. That's where you could learn. And so the notion that as you get older, you're resistant to technology, I think is really wrong. I do think you do ask yourself a question. Is this worth learning? And if the answer is it's worth learning, you do it.
Yeah, and I think part of it's also the mindset that people who tend to come down here tend to be, they've come down here. Oh, by the way, a lot of them come down here because they're economic refugees, but which plays into questions later on. But
right.
they are doing it and they're willing to take risks by coming to a foreign country and living someplace completely different. So let me ask you this. You discussed the 50 plus demographic are ideally suited to be entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Why?
Okay. So this to me is the big surprise. This is the unexpected. I would not have written that line, which I think I did write it. I think you're right about that. That's what I did write. I would not have written that line 5 years ago. But more and more, I become convinced. And 5 years ago, I still would have said, look, entrepreneurship is kind of your plan C, your plan D. I mean, you know, plan A, okay, the full-time job's not working out. We're going to go plan B, part-time work. Plan C, maybe some kind of flexible job. And then plan D, entrepreneurship, self-employment. And I use a very broad definition of entrepreneurship, by the way. If you're self-employed, as far as I'm concerned, you're an entrepreneur. You live in the 1099 economy. You got to do your own taxes. You got to bill people. You're doing the invoicing. You got to do your marketing, your pricing. So all of that is entrepreneurship. And this is where I think changes in the economy are exciting. First of all, and I'm talking on average, of course, but first of all, the people 50, 60, 70s, they're better educated than previous generations. Secondly, technology has really lowered the cost of starting a business. The third thing is that the office is the home, or you join a co-sharing workspace. Not that expensive. And so I had this image, and I think a lot of people did, that if you were starting a business, you were draining your 401k, you were putting all your retirement savings at risk, and that you shouldn't do. Just make that really clear. No, do not do that. But what a lot of people are doing, they're starting a business, it's bootstrapped, they're not even tapping into the 401k, they're keeping their costs down, and they can test their product or service in the market through an online And so just give one example, I read Keith Richards' book, The Life, his autobiography, and he was describing how when they taped in London in the 1960s, it was so expensive that they literally had, with a clock running, half an hour to do their taping, first taping, and how expensive studio space was. And he said, you know, today for like $2,000, somebody can have a beautiful studio in their garage. Now, it's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's pretty good. So I think this entrepreneurship slash self-employment with the artisan economy, the lifestyle economy, finding yourself an artisan craft niche, this is really exciting. It doesn't take a whole lot of risk, and it tends to do that thing that everybody is looking for. I want meaning. I want to have some fun. I want to do something that I enjoy. By the way, I also need to make money.
I am standing here in Mexico in my closet with literally I've got it padded with a sheet draped over the back of me. I've got a $60 microphone. I've got it plugged into my MacBook Air. I'm recording this on Piazza, which is a $19 piece of software. And I edit this on using Audacity, which is free.
That's exactly right. That's the point.
I couldn't do that 10 years ago.
No. And 10 years ago, if you were saying you're going to do what you're doing, I'd be cautioning about, well, you know, it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars to set up a studio. Do you really want to, you know, embark on that business? And of course, now, as you just said, it's just not that much.
Yeah, no, it's, and by the way, we're also seeing this in the tech industry, where it's really changed for the kids, because they can start something on a shoestring. And rather interesting, one of the differences is they're no longer interested in building big companies. They just want to build their first product and sell it and go on to the next thing.
And the other thing that they're doing, and I think this is a really exciting trend, this is a social change. And I don't know if you know, I was talking to Steve King. He's a consultant out of the Bay Area and consultant to small businesses. And we were having just a chat. And we both mentioned that we loved our fathers, absolutely loved our fathers. But the notion that I would have walked into and talked to my father, or my father would have talked to me about, let's go into business together, we'd go running out of the room, screaming. No way. This was never going to happen. Had nothing to do with love. Just wasn't going to happen. If my sons, and he made a point with his sons, if they walked in and said, Dad, would you like to go into business together? I'd drop everything in a heartbeat. Generations get along. And so one of the most exciting things that's going on right now, and I don't have any data to support this, but I am convinced that it's big, is right now, it'd be boomer parents going into business with their millennial and Gen X children. And the boomer parents have some kind of experience, probably a little more capital that they're bringing to the business. And the younger generation, a little more tech savvy, a little more hustle, and eventually they'll inherit the business.
Yeah, I've actually had several clients over the last few years have at least talked about doing this. And it's become easier and easier to do this. And of course, the relationship that our kids have with us is different than I had with my parents.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, my co-author on my book, Susan Leahy, she's just, all three of her kids have finally gotten out of the house. And she was really, they didn't want to leave. And of course, when I graduated from college, I got the hell out. I mean, actually, when I graduated from high school, I got the hell out. I don't want to live with my parents.
And I'm not talking about wealth. I'm just saying, think about the size of the typical median house today versus the size of the typical median house when you graduated from college.
Yeah.
And that typical median house probably only had one bathroom. No wonder our parents wanted us out, and no wonder we wanted out, right? And today, parents and their kids do get along better, but they're also living with a little more space.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm living down here in Mexico. The multi-generational family is just the norm. And what I want you also to talk about is, why is the multi-generational workplace a good thing?
I think the multi-generational workplace is really underestimated. And there's a whole consulting industry that is going around the country and they're saying, oh, can you believe it? You're going to have four generations under your roof. This is conflict. Your productivity is going to decline. And it's like, well, why? And there's all this survey data, and it's really compelling. And the survey data, IBM did a bunch of research that I thought was quite good. And they surveyed the various generations, and they have four generations. And what they came away with is, well, people basically share a lot of values. They want some autonomy to exercise their creativity. They want to be part of a team, a valued member of a team. They want to be treated with respect. They'd like to have opportunities for advancement. And yes, their histories are very different. I mean, if you think about me, where I'm at work, this is a multi-generational institution. You know, I'm largely shaped by the Vietnam War. I have people that I'm working with that were, you know, 8, 9 years old when the Iraq War was going on. So they don't share my experience in a direct sense. Of course, they're very different histories, but we share many of the same values when we're at work. So I think with a team, what happens is what the experience worker brings is experience. They do bring an ability to connect the dots. I've seen this. And this is what the research really shows, is that the experienced worker tends to be calmer in a crisis, tends to be a little more deliberate when things are really tense. And as you know, in every organization, there are those moments when it's all hands on deck. This is a tense moment. We got to deal with this, whether that's an automobile assembly line or that's a white collar office. And the younger ones, they have a lot of energy. They have a lot of knowledge. They bring a lot of skill to the team, but they don't have that well of experience to draw on. And so when you bring them together, it's a very productive unit. And one of the things that also the experienced worker brings to that team from an organizational point of view is they're transferring knowledge. And they're transferring a lot of that intangible knowledge, the stuff that is never written and can't be written, and who would read it anyway if it's in the organizational book about how we do things. This is the intangible knowledge about how we actually get stuff done.
I used to teach at IBM, 20 years ago, problem determination. And one of the things we knew was, if you had seen a problem in the same area before, you will solve the next problem faster.
Yeah.
It's called experience.
That's right.
And you can't fake experience. You can't speed it up. You just have to go do it.
You have to go do it. And experience doesn't mean you're stuck in your ways. That doesn't mean, and there's this image that the experienced worker is sitting back in their chair, folding their arms across their chest and saying, well, that's not how we did it in the past. That's not what we're talking about. This is about being able to connect the dots. You've seen this before. And yet, at the same time, the younger people are bringing a lot to the table, a new twist, something to maybe try a little bit differently. So this is why I think teams and thinking about multi-generational teams is something people want to encourage. And I don't think enough organizations are doing that yet.
Yeah, I run a multi-generational workshop. In fact, I'm coming back to Central Texas to run one of my workshops early March. And in fact, if for the listeners, you can go back and listen to the 3 episodes I did on the multi-generational. And the fact is, we echo back and forth. We can be quite complimentary as long as we remember that we're not. I like to say we echo off each other, i.e. when we leave home, we do one of two things. We either do exactly what our parents told us to do, or we do the exact opposite. And I can give you all kinds of examples.
Exactly. Yes.
So We know your book paints, you give lots of great examples, but we know that the world, there are all kinds of barriers.
Yes.
The first one, which I have experienced, is health insurance before 65, which is why I'm in Mexico, and then Social Security. What has to happen to fix our current system?
You know, this is where I just have been so frustrated with our whole conversation with the Affordable Care Act. Otherwise, people may know it more as Obamacare. And the thing about what the Affordable Care Act was trying to do is the most vulnerable population is about ages 55 to 65. Or 50 to 65. Because once you qualify for Medicare, now you're in a universal healthcare system. It may have its own drawbacks, but it's universal. And then there's also Medicaid for low income. But boy, if you're in that sort of area, 50 to 65, and you lose your job, you know, in our economy, you could probably get another job. But remember, many of those jobs are being created by small businesses. And small businesses often don't offer health insurance to their employees. And so what the Affordable Care Act was to try for the first time to create a viable individual health insurance market. And what has made me so frustrated is instead of sitting around and saying, look, there's some flaws to this. There really are. There's some real problems here. How can we improve it? How can we make this better? Because that's what we need to do. If you're 55, 56 years old, you should be able to pick up on an open market health insurance at a reasonable cost that's comprehensive. The skinny plans, the so-called skinny plans that they're starting to market these days, you know, they just don't cover very much. There's a reason that they're called skinny plans. So I'm really frustrated. I think this is the big issue that we have to face, and this is the drawback to the entrepreneurship that I've been talking about, which is I think more and more people are entrepreneurial. Entrepreneurship makes sense for more and more people, particularly as they age. There is a big jump in entrepreneurship once people reach age 65, and I don't think it's any surprise. It's because now they have universal healthcare. So we need to really work on this healthcare system, and let's stop saying what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act. Let's make it better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here in Mexico. We spent $25,000 in 2017 on health insurance and healthcare and did not reach our deductible.
See, that's insane.
Yeah, it is insane. Unfortunately,
that's just insane.
I could afford that, but geez.
Yeah.
And now I'm in Mexico. My wife's a retired RN, which means she's a pain in the butt patient. And she's been thrilled with the healthcare she's gotten here. And this summer, she saw a endocrinologist, a hematologist, a dermatologist, had blood work done and had her teeth cleaned. And we spent $150. That's without insurance.
Right.
Yeah. What's wrong with this picture?
There's a lot wrong with that picture. Right. And, you know, I just cannot read the line or hear the line. We have the best healthcare system in the world. We do not.
Right.
So we just don't.
So what do you think has to, I mean, Social Security, I mean, it's all going to go bankrupt here in 10 years or 15 years. So what's going to fix it?
So with Social Security there, I think that's actually a much more manageable problem. I mean, if you look at healthcare, it's now what, 17% of gross domestic product. It's a huge industry with huge entrenched interests. And there's no way to reform that system without gouging somebody. Somebody's pocket is going to get picked. There's just no way to do it, to have major reform without certain players getting hurt. Other players will probably benefit. So when you look at healthcare and you're thinking about reform, and what I admire about the Affordable Care Act is I thought it was an approach that said, look, we're not going to take away your employer-sponsored health insurance. But what we're going to do is if you're low income, we're going to expand Medicaid, and we're going to create these exchanges so that if you do lose your job, you have a viable option until you get to age 65. It's a very conservative plan, a very conservative approach. Now we need to build that. With Social Security, I think what we now have to realize is, look, Social Security is America's retirement savings plan. It just is. And what we're going to do is we're going to raise taxes to pay for it because too many people are dependent. We're not going to hit that magic number in 2034 when Social Security will only be able to pay 75% of promised benefits. We're never going to actually reach that point. The frustrating thing is right now, Congress knows this. They should deal with it. They should shore up the finances of Social Security, and eventually they will. And what's really striking is whether you're a Republican, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're a Trump supporter, whether you're a Tea Party supporter, no matter how you divide it, you can go to Pew Research and look at it. Basically, rounding out the numbers, 80% of the American people want Social Security to be strong. They want Social Security to be there. And I think that that's what we just simply need to do.
Yeah, there's no question that the existing retirement plans, the 401ks and all of that just doesn't work.
No, it just hasn't.
Well, for most people, okay, you take this sum of money and how do you invest it?
Yeah.
But for most people, they're not smart enough to know how to invest it versus when you had the defined benefit plans, you turned it over to somebody who was both experienced building the portfolio and then finally creating a paycheck at the end, which again, most of us don't know how to do.
Right. And part of it too is I think, you know, we underestimate the importance of time when we think about the way to address public policy. I mean, a two-income couple, 1968 versus now, they're working about a quarter more than their peer did back in 1968. And then we're supposed to keep up with new technology. And you're not just to have a partner. You're actually supposed to talk to your partner. And then you're supposed to eat healthy and exercise and not just brush your teeth, but you're also supposed to floss your teeth. And now on top of everything else, oh, by the way, you're supposed to vote and you're supposed to nurture your friendships. And on top of all of that, now you're going to really manage your money smartly over the next 30 years so that you have a good retirement. And when it comes to healthcare, we're actually going to create a system where you have to even make more decisions about your healthcare. We're asking so much of the typical person that they can't do it all. They can't do it all. And we need to acknowledge that. And most people, it makes no sense for them to manage their retirement savings.
This time last year, I was here in Ahihik and I was doing my income taxes with the debacle we had in 2017. And I was digging through my insurance portal health insurance portal. And put it bluntly, I was super confused.
Right. And you know what you're doing.
And I'm a really smart guy. So what does the average Joe do?
Right.
And it's like, geez. Anyway, I can get off my soapbox.
It's a good soapbox.
Yeah, I mean, it's I've written a number of blog posts on this topic, and it frustrates me no end. One thing I wanted to ask is, you talk about entrepreneurship in your book, but what about those folks who really they're not entrepreneurs, or they can't afford to start a business? What about them?
So here's the thing. The reason why I've been focusing so much on entrepreneurship, part of it is I think that is a surprise. And part of it is I think entrepreneurs are the leading edge of this bigger social change that we're talking about. And not all of us are entrepreneurs. Absolutely not. And where the bulk of people are going is part-time work, flexible jobs, maybe an encore career. There's a lot of people moving from the profit sector, intrigued by moving for the not-for-profit sector. And so I just have been focusing so much on the entrepreneurship because I think that's the leading edge of what we're talking about. Most people, it's going to be in the kind of work that education, social services side of things. There, I think one of the things, and this is what I know you work with your clients on, you know, the question has becoming as you, whatever age, 55, whatever age you want to name, the question is becoming, what do I want to do next? And, you know, I don't think that's that easy to figure out. I think it takes a lot of time and experimentation. So even though you're not going to be an entrepreneur, you kind of want to have an entrepreneurial mindset, a willingness to experiment. So someone's been a nurse. They have a set of skills, but you want to think about yourself not as your job title and not as your occupation, but what are your skills? What can you really do? I was talking to this woman in Montgomery County, and she'd been a teacher in high school and middle school. And what she realized is she had a really good skill in dealing with different constituencies. She trained with dealing with students, dealing with parents, dealing with other administrators, or the principal, and she took that skill and got herself involved in some committees in Montgomery County about economic development. Now, you think teacher, economic development, but her skill set is not that she was the one that's saying, here's what we should be doing. Her skill set was getting people to talk to each other.
Yeah, one thing I remember from your unretirement podcast that you mentioned in the book is the woman who learned to teach quilting and got certified, and she now can travel the country when she wants to and go teach quilting, which, by the way, was certified by a quilting pattern company.
Yes,
but the fact is, it's one of the things that goes on in my own online community. People go, "What? You can do that?"
Exactly.
The options are so broad now. And you basically, a lot of us suffer from what I call MSU disorder. And MSU stands for make stuff up. Right?
Right. Yeah. Right?
Well, I can't do that. Well, why can't you? Right. Or someone does that? What? No, no one does that. And the answer is yeah.
Yeah. And what she had, and this is one of the things that, because when I did that interview, here's one of my concerns. How do you know this isn't a scam, this quilting company thing, this certificate? And the thing is that her daughter and her daughter's partner, they had the daughter's partner had an MBA, she had an MBA. And so they did the research and they checked it out. And then they ran the numbers and they looked at the cost of what it was going to be to get that certificate, including travel and all that kind of, versus what she was actually going to be able to earn when she was teaching quilting. And the payback period was reasonably short. And it wasn't a scam, and the numbers worked. So you kind of go, reasonable risk. She'd been a nanny. That was her profession. Now she's going to be a quilting instructor. And you wouldn't think nanny to quilting instructor, but quilting had been a passion of hers, and now she was going to turn it into an income-earning occupation.
Yeah, it's amazing. One of the things in my online community, everyone needs their horizons broadened. Things that are possible today that weren't just 5 years ago is just pretty incredible. So, Chris, if there's one thing you'd like a reader to take away from this book, what would that be?
So the one thing, can I get two things?
One sure.
Practical, one practical and one attitude. So on the attitude side is to really be thinking that this moment of life, whether it's your 50s, your 60s, or 70s is a moment of opportunity, and to be engaged, to find something that gives you meaning and money, purpose and a paycheck, that is an exciting venture, and to sort of write your own narrative, write your own story, not the way that it's being written by the dominant society at this moment in time. So that's sort of the one thing I want you to take away, the opportunities and the prospects. On a practical level, I think what's really important is to exploit these opportunities that are out there. What we're talking about, think about what is your most valuable asset. It's not your home. It's not your retirement savings plan, if you have retirement savings. It's the network of people that you've met over the years. And tap into that network for two things. One, tap into them to help you broaden your horizons. I love that expression you just used. So, what is it they think you should be doing? You know, they know you. You're not an age. You're a person, and they know what your skills are. They know what your passions are, what you can do. So you can tap into your network to broaden your horizons and, you know, get some other ideas. And then when you kind of figure it out what it is you want to do next, what you're going to find is someone in your network is going to make the introduction that gets you that job or that opportunity that you'd like to explore.
I love that. So, Chris, If someone wanted to reach out to you and touch you, how would they do that? And then how would they get a copy of your book?
Right. So if they want to reach me, it's cfarrell, C-F-A-R-R-E-L-L, at gmail.com. So just email me. And as far as getting my book right now, it's on Amazon is the easiest place. I see it is at Target and it's at a number of other outlets. But right now, I think Amazon is the primary platform.
I mean, you've actually seen it in a bookstore?
I have seen it in a bookstore.
Ooh, I'm impressed.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Chris, thank you very much for being on the Repurpose Your Career podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. I always enjoy speaking with Chris as he is an evangelist for those of us in the second half of life. Susan Leahy and I are working on the next edition of Repurpose Your Career, and I'm looking for your help. I am forming a release team of readers who will access the pre-release chapters of the book to provide feedback. You can be part of this team by going to careerpivot.com/RYC team, where you can sign up. When you sign up, you'll receive the pre-release version of chapters when they become available. And what I ask in return is you provide feedback and be prepared to write an Amazon review when the book is published. The Career Pivot Community website has become a valuable resource for almost 50 members who are participating in the beta phase of this project. I am recruiting new members for the next cohort, and if you are interested in learning more about the endeavor and would like to be put on a waiting list, please go to careerpivot.com/community. When you sign up, you'll receive more information about the community as it evolves. It is those who are in these initial cohorts get to set the direction of this endeavor. This is a paid membership community where I'll be offering group coaching, special content, mastermind groups, branding sessions, Slack channels, and more importantly, it's a community where you can seek help. Please go to careerpivot.com/community to sign up to learn more. Feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn at linkedin.com/in/Mr. Miller. Yes, that's M.R. Miller. Just include in the connection request that you listen to this podcast. Look for Career Pivot on Facebook and LinkedIn. You'll also find me on Twitter at Career Pivot. Please come back next week when I interview Ashton Applewhite, author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. Thank you for listening all the way to the end of the Repurpose Your Career podcast. You will find all the show notes at careerpivot.com/episode-117. Please hop over to careerpivot.com and subscribe to get updates on this podcast and all the other happenings at Career Pivot. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Podbeam, Overcast, or Spotify. I hope to see you next Monday for another episode of Repurpose Your Career podcast.